Perfect. And we're back. Okay, I'm going to, I have on hold here our good friend. I think you guys know this guy. We're going to call him David F. There he is. He's got a couple questions about the debate and about some things that happened here.
Okay.
Are you there, David?
I'm there. Do you need me to turn off the broadcast while we...
Yeah, turn off the broadcast. We're in an echo.
Okay.
And we'll let Dr. Crosley go here soon because I'm sure he's pretty tired. So, David, appreciate you calling in here. This is David Fitzgerald, the author of the book Nailed and the author of the upcoming book. What is the title of your upcoming book?
Jesus Mything in Action.
So let me ask you this, David. After watching the debate, are you a historicist now?
No, I'm not a historicist. I mean, I'd be happy to become a historicist. It's not a dogmatic position I hold. But arguments like this, we're just scratching the surface. We're not even really getting at any of the real issues with this tonight. I have a lot of appreciation from both Dr. Ehrman and Dr. Price. I think Bob Price could have pushed back at a lot of points a little better than he did, I think. Especially, for instance, Ehrman's consistent position that the Gospels we have four Gospels, they're independent, and they're multiple. They're not the same Gospel over and over. Whereas we've known for decades, no, hundreds of years actually, the synoptic problem points out that all these Gospels that we have in our canonical Gospels originate with Mark and go out from there. He keeps referring to the other sources that had to have existed and that they had to have been oral tradition, but these are all hypothetical, and there are other answers that don't rely on it being oral tradition. And in fact, the literary composition of these Gospels, we see the Greek roots of it. We see that some of these things only work in Greek. We see that the Aramaic words that are in there come in as phrases to add color, and they're always translated for the Gentile audience that's reading them.
Dr. Crosley, not to cut you off, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Let me ask you to respond to that if I could.
Yeah. It's very difficult. Translation is a very difficult process in one sense. I mean, a Greek translator, assuming there is an Aramaic underlying, let's say, will of course be looking to make it comprehensible to a Greek-speaking and understanding audience. So in one sense, that can make it very difficult to know if there's any Aramaic underlying it. However, there are some. I mean, there's some that aren't just translations, I don't think. I think it's very difficult to do this fully. I mean, Bauman referred to it, but he didn't give any specific examples. But you could do something like Son of Man. Son of Man is a Semitic idiom, and it looks like it's a specific Aramaic idiom as well. And if you take a passage like Mark 2:27 through to 28, it looks like a generic use of the Aramaic idiom Son of Man with a reference to speaker. And that gets dropped by Luke and Matthew to make it into a title. So you could perhaps make a case there. There's certain things, old arguments about Aramaic causing confusion between two different passages. So there's the passage in Matthew 23 and Luke 11 about giving alms versus, purifying versus giving alms. And they sound very similar and look quite similar in Aramaic. And you get it as well with tithing, mint, dill, and cumin, and rue, and all kind of herbs in Luke. There's some very similar Aramaic words which can account for differences. And there's other things like Aramaic idioms such as forgiving debts and repentance. So there's things you can do with Aramaic. I'm not saying this takes it back to Jesus or anything like that. I'm saying this takes it back to it.
If I might chime in as well, I think that in addition to the Aramaic, you know, the Aramaic is one piece of the puzzle, and there's no doubt that one can doubt anything. The question is, where does the evidence point, and what's more probable given the evidence? In these same passages where we have traces of Aramaic words, some of the specific passages that James Crossley just mentioned, we have Jesus depicted as debating with groups that only existed prior to the destruction of the temple, that existed in Palestine, that weren't debates that were being held in other places, that weren't of interest to non-Jews to whom the religion was later promoted. And so to come up with scenarios on which these things are invented much later in a very different context just doesn't make as good sense of the evidence.
Well, hang on. Let me respond to that point especially, because you're talking about groups like the Pharisees, like John the Baptist cult, that were rivals to early Christianity. We do see them in that context, the post-gospel context, the post-temple destruction context.
And you'd claim that they were invented after the destruction of the temple?
I'm saying that these are all coming from the gospels that were written after the destruction of the temple, yes.
Okay, no, but are you saying that the group centered on John the Baptist invented John the Baptist in a later time, and the Pharisees invented Hillel, and...
But I'm saying those
why groups, not? Why not be a thoroughgoing mythicist? Why doubt Jesus but not every similar figure from the same time period? I'm curious.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I do have my doubts about John the Baptist. I don't have doubts about Paul. But if you read Nailed, and I think you have read Nailed, I have a whole chapter on, at the end of it, what would be different, can Jesus be saved, that would put me a lot closer to accepting that there was at least a guy named Jesus.
Yeah, actually, I blogged about your book back in 2011, and we interacted a little bit after that. And as I said then, I'll say again now, you know, you still seem to be trying to not do what Ehrman described so eloquently, I thought, in the debate, which is take each piece of evidence and evaluate it in terms of probability, but looking for a quick all-or-nothing answer to the question.
He
existed as depicted in these sources, or there was no historical Jesus.
And I was going to say, I have spent the last 4 years responding to the criticisms that arise from Nail, and that's what the new book is coming out this year. Okay. But let me just back up just a little bit on that. The hypothetical sources, this picking and choosing that they're saying, there's so many sources that are going into this that Bob Price in the debate was saying, well, this goes back to Gnosticism, this goes back to Zoroastrianism. We don't have to go outside of Judaism and early Christianity to get sources that say, for instance, he kept making fun of the idea that Jesus being in outer space. We have Paul talking about Paul in outer space. We have Jewish writings talking about these things happening in the lower levels of heaven, in the revelation of Moses, in the ascension of Isaiah, in the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews in our own New Testament talks about a Jesus who does all these things in a heavenly body.
Who goes into the heavens. Yes. So I think that actually is wonderful evidence against
everything
mysticism,
there happens in
right?
the heavens.
That Paul, who you agree is a historical figure, travels to the heavens. That Jesus, who the author of the Hebrews views as a human being, travels into the heavens to offer his sacrifice.
I disagree.
And so
one
can selectively cite evidence in order to try to make a case. And
okay,
I think
we're gonna play
I think you've given one of the biggest problems with mythicism, which is that you can make the mythicist case by quoting Zoroastrian sources. You can make the mythicist case by saying they're deriving from Jewish sources. Mythicism is simply saying it was invented. It's not based on anything.
Well,
and you can appeal to anything to make that case. If you can appeal to anything to make a case, then it clearly has no evidentiary value if you can make a case with any kind of argument whatsoever.
David, go ahead, and then I got to intercede here for just a second, but I want to hear David's last point real quick.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying this is not falsifiable. It totally is. But what I'm saying is when you say – go on.
How is it falsifiable?
I was just mentioning I had a whole chapter of ways that it would be falsifiable. Bob Price mentioned in his talk what would be falsifiable. What I'm saying is we have evidence. We're not denying evidence. We're not ignoring evidence. There is plenty of evidence out there. We know that the Gospels are myths about Jesus. Whether there was a Jesus or not as a real person, we know that these stories are not true about Jesus. We know
you know that all of them are not true in any detail.
I'm not saying all of them, but do you know what I do go in the new book? I do go through every bit of the Gospel of Mark and showing how it has inventions, allusions to other Old Testament writings and other Jewish writings, allusions to Greek writings. We see over and over again that on the mythicist basis, everything we see makes sense. And over, not just in the Gospels, but in the New Testament.
I mean, can I come in there?
Yeah, Dr. Crosley, because he's got to go soon.
Yeah. I don't know if you can make the claim either way, Sim. So if you take something like Mark 7, there's a dispute over hand washing. You know, let's, you know, there's stuff here and there. But could Jesus have argued with Pharisees about hand washing? Sure, without a doubt. Did he? I don't know. I can't prove it. But I don't think you can prove the negative on that. I think it's certainly culturally plausible in 20s Galilee or 20s Palestine to be arguing over details of whether you wash hands before before a meal or take Sabbath observance or something like this. You could easily be debating that. I can't prove it. I can't prove it
and
either.
I totally agree with you. I say in the book, I'm not out to make people Jesus mythicists, Jesus atheists. I'm out to make them skeptical Jesus agnostics.
David,
when push comes to shove, at the end of the day, we can't know what Jesus really said or really did.
I'll
we
let
have
add.
To look at the sources, and our sources aren't good enough to tell us that.
I'll let Eric respond here, Jessica. I just want to say, Dr. Crosley, you're free to go. I'm sure it's crazy late, and I appreciate you staying up with us.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Crosley.
I'll stand on for 5 more minutes, and I'm going to go to bed.
Okay.
That's fine.
Well, we'll get one more point from David, and then you can respond. David, what would be the strongest argument for mythicism that Robert Price did not touch on this evening?
Oh, boy. One thing I'd like to say that he didn't point out that yesterday's blasphemy is tomorrow's consensus when it comes to biblical studies. He didn't talk about the Christian bias that pervades biblical studies, no matter how you feel about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. He didn't talk about how many scholars are contractually obligated to deny mythicism today. We talked a little bit about there's a spectrum of belief within, biblical studies, Jesus studies. I hear snickering, but
yeah, if that's the best argument, then mythicism is even in worse shape than I believed, because that it's something that's not inherently crackpot, but the conspiracy theory approach, that because they're conservative Christian institutions where people have to sign statements of faith, therefore James Crossley and James McGrath and Bart Ehrman and all these people who work at secular institutions who are quite happy to say things, sometimes maybe not so happy, but who say things because we're persuaded that they're true, that our students who are people of faith don't like us saying, but we're persuaded that they're true, and we say them, and we're under no contractual obligation to say one thing or the other. Using that as though that makes mythicism more plausible just shows it's a conspiracy theory approach to the whole thing.
It's not a conspiracy theory to point out that Christian bias is a real thing. Do you know any Christians
and atheist bias is not okay, who are, then they are even agnostic about Jesus? But we have atheist bias, we have Christian bias. Let's take them out of the picture and say, what do the historians who are Christians, who are atheists, who are agnostics, who are Jews, converge upon consistently when they're coming from their different perspectives? Maybe that's where it's more likely that there's agreement that doesn't simply reflect ideological bias.
Well, let's talk about that agreement. You talk about the consensus on Jesus. One of the big problems with Jesus studies is there is no consensus. And after 3 so-called historical quests of Jesus, we're in a bigger muddle than ever. If we had Anthony LaDon tonight, he could talk about the demise of authenticity that Christians
are... Yeah, again, this is what I was talking about before you got on, which is the selective appeal to scholarship as though these people actually support you, which is exactly what evolution deniers and others do when they cite scholars, but will not follow through where those scholars end up with their arguments. But to talk about what Anthony LaDon has to say about this, because I'd like to actually respond to your point, the suggestion that we simply can't know these things with any degree of confidence why is there disagreement? Because we have so many people interested in this figure, and we are contractually obligated to do, we have to say something new and get it published, right? Unless we want to go your route and self-publish and do other things, go to other kinds of presses, which, doesn't count for tenure and doesn't count for promotion and things like that. We have to publish and we have to have new ideas. And we have this many people working in a field, there are going to be floating new ideas. You don't look for what are the different ideas that are people. You look again for the consensus. And there is no consensus.
Not only does
then you haven't been paying a lot of attention.
I have been paying attention for 15 years on this, James. Every single secular biblical historian believes in a Jesus, at the very least, that completely bunks what every single Jesus of faith out there is.
All right, Crosley, do you want to respond to that? Then I'm going to introduce our academic advisors on the line, Daniel Galuta, and I know David's somewhat familiar with Daniel. You two had a debate a while ago. But Crosley, I'd like to hear your response before you fall asleep on us.
It's a very interesting one. I mean, I wonder if some of this reflects a bygone era that we need to destroy. And that's the era of the Crossans, the Wrights, the Sanders, where we think these are the things that stand for scholarship. And they were obviously all great scholars in their own right. But I think we're really starting to see a shift, a generational shift in historical Jesus studies, where so there are some interesting areas of consensus. I think there will be more consensus on, and there already is, on the authenticity stuff, thanks to Ladon and Chris Keith. I suspect. Probably everyone here may well actually agree with that. And different ways of doing it. We may not get so many, this is my Jesus, that's my Jesus. I think we might start thinking more broadly in terms of thematic issues. And again, if I bring up someone like Chris Keith, who's worked both on the authenticity stuff and memory, his stuff on Jesus and the scribal elite, he's my colleague, I'm biased, okay? Well, that could cut right across. I can cut right across... whether it's a James McGrath or it's me or even, you know, someone who's conservative. I think there will be a difference now. I think there's a lot of people pissed off with a generation of Jesus scholarship gone by. And I think there'll be, I know there's a lot of people working together. There's some pretty hefty disagreements, don't get me wrong. But I think you'll find, I'm hoping anyway, there will be a shift away from them, you know, my cynic Jesus, my prophet Jesus, my whatever Jesus, to kind of something quite different ways of looking at this question. And that's, I'm saying that as someone kind of active in this field at the kind of conferences where there's actually quite a lot more disagreement, a lot more agreement than I think some, you know, our assessments of older scholarship would have us believe.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Crosley. And again, thanks for sticking through it.
Pleasure. I go to bed now.
All right. Good night, sir.
Thank you.
Good night, James.
David, do you have more time?
I'm
or
Daniel, obviously, but you know.
Well, Daniel, are you there?
The first thing is, I'm going to go to bed.
Are you there, Daniel?
You can't leave.
am I coming first?
Yes, I hear you, Daniel.
Okay.
You're a little quiet though.
Is that better?
Yeah, better enough. David, do you still have more time, or do you need to go?
I can stick around.
Okay, I know it's late for everybody, and we kind of have a Jesus hangover from the debate, but Eric is going to kind of take over here and ask a few questions.
Daniel, what was your impression of the debate, and what were you think were some of the highlights?
Did you hear that, Daniel?
No, I didn't, sorry. Eric's cut very low.
He asked what was the highlight of the debate? Who do you think gave the best argument? Not so much who won, but who gave a clearer argument?
Well, I'll talk about two highlights from each side. I think, once again, a testament to Dr. Ehrman's ability to be a clear and concise communicator, whether it's his lectures or his books or his blog. I think you could probably extract his opening statement, and I think that's a pretty good case for people to believe that there was a man named Jesus, regardless of what we think about him. So I thought, once again, Ehrman's clarity is just a testament to his scholarship. As for Price, I really enjoyed his honesty, that he was fully aware, of the caps between them, and he was willing to engage in the disagreements, and he actively highlighted where they agreed, where they disagreed, and I thought for the most part it was a pretty collegial debate. And, you know, anytime Price jumps into accents and jokes, I think he's just he's got a great comedic wit about him, so.
One of the
I really
points...
enjoyed the scholarly tone of it too, the congeniality between it. That's something we don't see a lot in this arena.
I agree.
Well, in the public, anyway. If you go to SBL, I think Dr. Crossley and Dr. McGrath would agree with me that this is pretty... I think this is pretty common, especially in the open panels and stuff.
I
would say that.
One thing that stood out to me was Dr. Ehrman's explanation of the usage of brothers when he was speaking about Paul and his recollection of meeting Caiaphas and James. How did that resonate with you, Dr. McGrath?
Yeah, I've tried to make that point before, especially in conversation with mythicists. I don't think I've ever made it as clearly as Bart Ehrman did tonight, and so I was very appreciative of that.
David, how do you approach that section of the letter, the relationship between James and the supposed brother of Christ usage, right, and the difference between that and just being members of a closed community?
Well, my biggest problem with that is that if he really thinks that these guys are Jesus' disciples and brothers, then the next passages make no sense of why he thinks they're nobodies and false Christians, and he doesn't agree with them for a moment, and why he's constantly at loggerheads with them.
Sure it does.
Whereas if these are figures from Paul's letters who become characters in the Gospels, then it makes a lot more sense to me.
I have to respond. I don't see the argument. I mean, you think that someone could not disagree with someone else who, as we get from Galatians, you know, it's fairly clear that some people have gone to Galatia and are challenging Paul's authority and are claiming to speak on behalf of the Jerusalem Christians. And so he's both and saying that they agreed with him and that, you know, he doesn't depend on their authority. And there's been so much work done on this. I don't understand why it seems so hard to understand.
It is hard to understand that if he feels the need to prop up his own authority, why does he never appeal to Jesus in this case when it would have sensed the whole argument? Why
he
does
he say, does appeal?
I know these are his brother and his number one disciple, but he never even uses the word disciple in any context ever in any of his writings. He never implies that Jesus had 12 of them. He never identifies the 12.
Are you thinking of apostle?
He talks about apostles, but when he describes what an apostle is, it has nothing to do with being a disciple of Jesus who followed him around.
But I think it's characteristic that mythicists, you know, don't know the terminology that's used in these sources, have a superficial familiarity with it, and then they're confused by it and think that that proves something. And this is, I think, actually illustrates an important point.
You know, I don't even know why you're here, James, to be honest with you. Because what else are you going to say besides shitting on mythicism?
I'm
going to point out that you actually don't know what the sources say. You don't know the terminology. When a student in my class says the Bible's important to them, and they talk about the Book of Revelations with an S at the end, I'm like, they haven't even looked at the title carefully, right? I know that there isn't actual familiarity. They're paying lip service to the text, but they don't actually know it.
Okay. Eric, you have a question for Daniel?
Yeah.
Or do you want to respond? Let's let David respond, then I'll have...
Ever so briefly, I'm not going to get into a pissing match about...
No, don't. This is not a pissing match. I'm talking about the evidence. I want you to talk about the evidence.
No, I'm not talking about the evidence. What I'm saying is there is evidence out there that is consistently brushed over, hand-washed away. And you just laugh about, it's very easy if you just understand, as if you know, that these are all simple problems that have been solved long ago. You're harumphing them away just the same way this has always been done. And yet these arguments, even arguments from Celsus, from Porphyry in the second century, are still holding up because they haven't been explained.
I think Ehrman did a good job explaining them tonight. And I think that biologists harumph all the time when people say, but there are problems. Old arguments.
People try to make the false analogy that this is some kind of creationism for atheists, I really get worked up about that because the opposite is true. In every single instance, what they point at mythicism, and I'm talking about serious mythicism. We all know there's crackpot mythicism like Joseph Atwell, who's you know, out there and just...
What makes him a crackpot compared to the ones that you like, other than the fact that, you know, I mean, what
because
makes someone a crackpot?
Because we're saying tonight, it's the paradigm that makes the best explanation for the evidence that we have, of all the evidence we have.
I gotta.
Yeah, well, the creationists actually do say, you know, all time and time again, it depends on your lens, right? We're looking at the same evidence. It just depends on your lens.
All right, I have a question. I gotta ask some questions here from Twitter. I'm getting a few. I'll let you answer this, Daniel, since you're quiet. You know, if you need to go, David, since we're live and this is kind of unorganized a little bit, you're welcome to say, "Hey, my time's up." Okay.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, I appreciate you. Let me ask this question real quick, and I'll point it to you, Daniel. Tim C. wrote me on Twitter at Who Was Jesus Show. Why would Paul make the point he was not lying in Galatians 1:20? Were there people who would have thought he was lying?
Yes. That's the way I would do that is if basically the fact that Paul has to go through this rigmarole saying, like in Galatians 1, and I actually wanted to challenge David on this about the authority of Jesus. He does appeal to the authority of Jesus in Galatians 1:1. Paul, an apostle, not sent from men or a man, but from Jesus Christ and God the Father, who raised him from the dead, etc., etc. So the fact that he says that he's not sent from a man, the fact that he has to say that he's not lying, to me says that the people in Antioch, the people in Galatia, are undermining his authority. And by mere reading the text, like my mentor, Dr. Ian Elmer at the Australian Catholic University has done a great job on, is what the most obvious thing he thinks is happening, and most commentaries think this, people are claiming that Paul does not have the authority, and if he does, he probably got it from men, so it's interchangeable, and that he could be lying about his credentials. So that's why Paul is on the defensive. People are attacking him.
David, do you want to respond, or do you agree?
Well, they certainly were attacking him, but whenever he justifies his where he's getting this from, it's always from Scripture or Revelation. It's always either this is what happened according to Scripture, or it's that, you know, he gets it from the Lord who is whispering in his ear from heaven, live from heaven.
All right, I have another question sent in from Twitter here. Was Mark Jewish? Question mark. I'll pose that to you, Dr. McGrath. I wish I would have got that when Crosley was on, because we were messaging on Facebook back and forth. But let me ask you,
yeah,
McGrath.
Was Mark
Jewish?
That surprised me. I'm not, you know, we have so little information that, you know, it's possible that he wasn't, but most people, to my, you know, my understanding, assume that he was, given that, you know, he's where he's present, where he lives, the odds were that he would have been Jewish. The fact that he has a non-Jewish name is not indicative, because, you know, Jews were found everywhere in the world and used names from everywhere in the world. So
can I offer the counterpoint on that, because I've gotten the opposite perspective.
Sure. Yeah.
Just that, like, because Mark mishandles scripture, like incorrect quotations. That's the answer. I'm not saying
I was thinking of Mark as John Mark, the individual that Paul mentions in his letter.
I think the question was posed to the author of the gospel.
Was the author of Mark Jewish? And there, yeah, it's quite possible that it wasn't. Yeah.
Crossley thinks the author of Mark was Jewish and was exceptionally early, but I think I can speak to James.
Well, Crosley dates.
Yeah,
I don't want to speak for Crosley because he's off the line, but he when we interviewed him for a project, he dated Mark at 40 CE. What about you, David? You have a pretty good section in your new book on the Gospel of Mark. You think he was Jewish?
I agree with what you both said. The author of the book of Mark was not as Jewish as, say, the author of the Gospel of Matthew, who corrects his mistakes. I don't know. I agree with all your points on the actual John Mark that appears in Paul's letters.
I have a question. I'll first pose it to Daniel. The idea of Mormonism and comparisons to Joseph Smith came up at least twice during tonight's debate. Has that ever occurred to you to make parallels or draw comparisons in the mythicist debate with Mormonism? Daniel?
Who was that question for?
That's for Daniel.
To me, it's so... I honestly don't understand, like, I would say the best comparison you have for Mormonism is not early Christianity, but rather you could point to perhaps like Islam, because you have a prophet who receives active revelations and produces a new scripture from it. But however, even the parallels stop there, because Joseph Smith claims to unearth an ancient scripture, not dictate an ancient scripture. So to me, the parallels between the two don't really make sense. A prophet in religious studies, to me, is a category that doesn't really make sense of the comparisons that mythicists make. I think you could call the historical Jesus a prophet-like figure because of the data, but honestly, the comparisons that were brought up and have been brought up, I don't think works. And I know Carrier thinks there is comparisons, but as you know, I don't buy it.
David, one of the final questions, if not the ultimate question at the Q&A section of the debate, the asker replied to Ehrman's early comments about crucifixion and how Ehrman thought that was a strong, compelling argument. And the question was, much like Joseph Smith had to lose the tablets, the early followers who came up with the myth had to kill Jesus off. And that's ultimately why there's an appeal to crucifixion. As someone who is both a mythicist and interested in Mormon history, how do you align with that argument?
I did raise an eyebrow when Mormonism came up, but to be honest with you, I'm not as impressed with the parallels with Mormonism, Joseph Smith and Paul or Jesus, if you will. I think it's interesting, more interesting, the question that came out at the very end saying that Bart was saying that, and Kurt Noll has echoed this, that Christianity doesn't start with the resurrection. It starts with the first Christians preaching the resurrection. And that's a really interesting distinction to make.
Can I jump in on the place?
Sure. Go ahead. I had another question, but no, go ahead. Jump in real quick, Daniel.
Well, just the problem is Smith's the traditions left behind that Smith indicates what happens to the plates are quite various. Like at times he says that he gave them back to Moroni. At other times they seem to go back into the hill Cumorah. At other times they're accompanied by a whole other cast of plates. So once it, like the language, the question that he had to quote unquote lose the plates, I thought was problematic as a Mormon historian.
Couldn't agree more, because there's at least six or seven different stories that we've parsed out, and apparently none of them were being preached like for the first 10 to 15 years of Mormonism. That blows my mind that wasn't right there from the get-go.
One of the things that still kind of unsettles with me or sits with me is Paul, when he talks about the Last Supper or the Eucharist, he makes it a point to say he did not get that from any man. He makes a point to say he got it from a special revelation of Jesus. And so I'll pose this to Dr. McGrath here. Why would Paul say that? It seems like he wants people to know, I have a special revelation of Jesus. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me answer that. But first, let me say that if you're thinking of 1 Corinthians, where Paul gives his account of, he talks about what I received from the Lord, right? Which I think that someone like Robert Price would say, as he said about a number of pieces of evidence, it's one where it's ambiguous and you need to ask, what does he mean by that? How is he using this terminology? Just as we could say, in theory, there's no reason you could would exclude a priori that Paul might have been talking about archons in the celestial realm. You ask, how does he use the word elsewhere and things like that? In this case, I think it makes very little sense to suggest that Paul was claiming that his knowledge of what happened to disciples of Jesus, what happened to in relation to the handing over, as he calls it, the betrayal, and things of that sort, were things that came from some kind of special revelation. And you know, certainly to treat them, you know, to take that seriously and to suggest that Paul meant that, actually, you know, is essentially invoking a miracle if you take his claim seriously, because then he ends up agreeing with a much more widespread tradition that doesn't seem to all stem from Paul's letters. He mentions that and a number of other points at which he agrees with the wider church. And so he's often trying to emphasize his independence from other sources of authority and thus his own authority. But it makes very little sense to treat those things as things that he received directly from the Lord, as opposed to in the same way that he received things, you know, says, not I say, but the Lord, and is echoing the Jesus tradition, it would seem, at least according to, you know, the viewpoint of most historians and scholars.
I'd just say, look at the Greek. Like, when you look, is it paradako? Paradako?
Paradomi.
Yeah, it's hand over. Like, and from what I can see in Greek lexicons, it's just passing. So I'm with you, James, that I don't understand how it works, but yeah.
Well, and it's interesting, in any other case in the New Testament, when they're using that verb, it's not in the sense of betrayal. It's in the sense of delivering up, handing over, as James just said.
I was talking about tradition, not
There's a lot of handing over in that passage.
Yeah, yeah. It's lots of variations of power.
So let's have tons of more questions. I'm not going to get to all of them here. Daniel, I'll let you answer this because you have a thesis on Marcion. Did Marcion write any of the Gospels?
No. Okay. It is very sexy to blame Marcion for almost anything in early Christianity. It is a very good way to sell books. But when we look at the earliest Christian traditions, what Marcion is blamed for, and he is blamed in the most horrible, propagandist way ever. Like, for example, when Irenaeus says that the worst thing about Marcion is that he comes from Pontus is the worst place. Yeah, Pontus is the worst place on earth, but it's still not as bad because Pontus is where Marcion was born. Like, you know, it's just the stuff they say about Marcion is awful. What they do say is they call Marcion a cutter. He uses the knife to cut away at the gospel. So what you can infer from that, and I would agree with the majority of apostolic scholars of the second century, Marcion probably was an editor of some kind, not a creator. He did not create gospels. He probably edited them in some way. How he did it, where he did it, what time frame, that's up for debate, but he was an editor, not a creator.
Yeah, and there was actually a whole panel on, you know, Marcion and the Gospels at SNTS in Montreal this summer, and it seems that the main alternative to that is not that Marcion wrote a Gospel, but that Marcion inherited a different version of the Gospel of Luke. But it seems that Marcion's distinctive text, while it may have had edits that he made, and it certainly may have supported his views in some ways, didn't consistently support his views. And right. So some think that it may have been inherited by him.
Jason Badoon's got a great... Yeah. Jason Badoon, I should have... I was just trying to give a quick answer, but you're absolutely right.
I just want to emphasize that the main scholarly alternative scenario doesn't have Marcion writing the Gospels either, which I think is for the present discussion.
David, I have a question specifically for you. Papias claims he knew John the Elder.
Papias claims a lot of things. Go ahead.
Yeah, he claims he knew John the Elder and had, you know, oral traditions from the apostles. Is that not evidence that
Judas
not good
really
evidence
died by blowing up as a pinata of pus and vomit? But you know. that's very problematic claims, all his claims. And it's even problematic if that's what he was actually claiming, that, you know, he talks about John the Elder, but, you know, it's you know, that we don't even know if he was implying that that was the same John that is the Apostle John or just another John. But he definitely claims that he has all this, you know, line going back to the apostles, just like all the church fathers did. They all had that arms race of apostolic succession.
Which is still pervasive, especially in Eastern Europe and in Egypt and other places. If you go to these churches, they'll pull out a book with a whole genealogy and connect their specific congregation back to the apostolic fathers.
You try to tell a Coptic Christian anything, and he'll just look at you like, "No, we got the real story." You know?
Right. Well, I guess what would make Papias unique, was the time frame. It was very early, and it would be plausible he actually could have known a Peter or a John, I suppose.
Well,
yeah, and I think
it's possible.
Yeah, I think the question of whether he knew any of these people is different from, you know, was he telling the truth about what he knew? Was he remembering anything that any of these people said to him? And those are important, you know, separate questions. And I think one thing that often gets lost in this kind of discussion is that we can have people who were early eyewitnesses who get things wrong. We can have people who are writing much later and who get things right. It's not always the case, though. So we need to treat each piece of evidence and evaluate it on its own terms. And, you know, I mean, I think one thing that we see in the case of the gospel tradition is that, you know, increasingly the gospels that are anonymous are associated with authority figures, and then those claims are actually made explicitly within the very text itself. And, you know, it strikes me that some of the gospels, you know, in the New Testament seem to predate the shift in time to when anyone who was writing something gave it a clear title, an unambiguous association with an authority figure, because some of them were not 100% sure who wrote them.
And just to add another problem, we also don't know, because we don't have Papias, we have Irenaeus quoting Papias, so
right.
The initial question is Irenaeus faithfully interpreting him? Like that's
yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, going back to the debate, that was one point that I think could have been made a little stronger, is that there comes a point where we don't have the autographs, we don't have the original manuscripts, and there's a huge blackout period where we don't even have any way to identify how close our oldest existing New Testament manuscripts are to the originals.
Well, we do have a way of dating, you know, through paleography and sometimes even through things like carbon dating, dating manuscripts. The question, of course, then comes, you know, how close is that to the events? Because mythicists sometimes have a very different view of when some of the stories are supposedly set. But the Gospels themselves mention figures from the first century. And so, I mean, clearly we have an anchor, at least in the storytelling. And the situation that, you know, was just mentioned is not uncharacteristic. It's not as though the Gospels are this unique problem where we don't have the original documents, and so we're relying.
Oh,
you
know, no,
it's the situation across the board when it comes to, you know, our knowledge of ancient history. And so the question is, how early are our manuscripts? Do we have reason to think, given the extent to which they change across different manuscripts, that we can deduce from the existing manuscripts something that what the original is likely to have looked like? It's, again, a question of probability. History doesn't, especially ancient history, doesn't give you the kind of certainty that a lot of people want when it comes to the question of Jesus.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Bart Ehrman was definitely in hostile territory. And Daniel sent me a message during the Q&A that it seems like a mythicist runaway, because it was mostly mythicists asking the question. So do any of us think Ehrman communicated so well that perhaps he switched some people's positions in the audience who may have been mythicists? Was he that good of a communicator? Let me start with you, David, since you are the mythicist.
Speaking as the token mythicist, I mean, it felt like he brought out the same arguments that he's used before, and that I thought we were already past that. You know, saying that that he knew the brother of the Lord, that we've kind of done that one to death. Talking about the thing that really bothered me is when he keeps talking about the sources being multiple and independent, as if the synoptic problem didn't exist, as if there was no, you know, evidence that these documents are based off each other, as if the Gospel of John had anything to do with them at all. I was really kind of taken aback by that, especially since in Did Jesus Exist and in his book How Jesus Became God, I could see some shift where you could see so that things that earlier he was a lot more certain were better established than they are, I think he's beginning to realize they're not quite as established as he used to think they were. And so I see the beginnings of a shift to him. For instance, when they were talking about the kenosis hymn in Philippians, and he, you know, Price brought out that the very verse itself says that Jesus gets the name Jesus after his death. And he kind of hand-waved that away in a way that I didn't find convincing at all. And I suspect the rest of the audience wasn't convinced by a lot of the things he was saying because they've heard them before and there's been responded to.
Well,
Dr. McGrath.
Jump in on that one point, which is that Philippians 2:6-11, that passage says that Jesus receives the name which is above every name. And there's no way that a Jewish author would have thought that the name above every name is Joshua. The name above every name is the divine name, and we have other texts in which the divine name is bestowed upon agents. It happens with Metatron. It happens with the angel Yahuel. In Samaritan texts, you know, it happens to Moses. And so it seems to me that that's the meaning, and that's why Jesus then receives this universal acclamation as God's supreme agent, which echoes a text that refers to the acclamation that goes to the one God alone.
Well, this is the thing. And I'm really trying not to sound insulting at this point, David. But
go hit me.
No. I don't know what else can be done. Like, we have four gospels, seven letters, and Josephus, and some other stuff. I mean, the so-called battleground for this is small. So, like,
are we really going to bring in Josephus?
But here's the thing, though. If you didn't bring up Josephus, it would be a gap. Whether you think he's historical or not, we only have so much to work from, and so we've done the brother of the Lord to death thing. It's like, in my opinion, it hasn't been convincingly proved that it is just a communal Christian brothers. But even if it has, like, there's only seven letters. There's only seven letters of Paul. But the point I want to make is back to your synoptic problem thing. Mm-hmm. The point you raised is this is the issue. I dare say you agree with Mark Goodacre. Am I assuming right?
Yes.
Okay. And this is my point. My point is that Price and Ehrman agree with the two-source hypothesis, which is the vast majority, like most scholars, agree on that. So if they disagreed on that, we would have a very different debate. We'd have different questions being raised.
Sure.
But the fact that they do agree on that creates a dialogue about, you know, the nature of that independence. Like, what is the nature of Q? And Price clearly goes for Burton Mack's theory about Q1, 2, and 3, where Ehrman, and that's fine that you're not happy with it. My point is, if they disagreed on the two source hypothesis, this would be a completely different discussion.
Sure.
You can see that happening in the Q&A section when Price got, I don't know if it was offended or upset, because he put down the microphone when he was challenged, when Ehrman challenged, when they started talking
about the history of Paul. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
And to be fair, I would have probably said something very like Ehrman too, because the thought that all of Paul's letters are forgeries, seems way out there to me as well.
My point is, this is what I was talking to Matt and Eric before the debate started. My major concern for this debate was, how are these two even going to have a dialogue, because most of it's going to be about Paul probably, and Price doesn't even think Paul wrote anything. So it's just seeing any type of this, to me, this is why this debate gets so fickle.
Well, we've covered some.
Worse than that, because I was thinking when I was watching the debate, mythicists and historicists, for the most part, in that there's any kind of agreement at all, and we've already done talked about the consensus thing. We agree. The serious mythicists agree with most of what the consensus is saying these days. I think we just take it a little bit further. I don't think it's an all or nothing proposition, and we certainly don't claim to have mathematical certainty of any of this.
I'll let James respond to that.
Well, I would just say that, you know, I think Ehrman articulated well that, you know, the distinction, you know, is important. You know, he said that, you know, don't you basically agree that the Jesus of the Gospels is fictional? And, you know, on one level you could answer yes, but on the other hand, you know, we could also have people agreeing that, you know, Caesar as depicted in this source, or, you know, the Jewish war as depicted by Josephus is fictional. Well, it depends what you mean. It's not entirely fictional. And that's a crucial difference for those who are concerned about history.
And I totally agree. And I think that's kind of the crux of the problem, is like, we know these Gospels are myths about Jesus. The question is there a real Jesus at the bottom of them, or is it myth all the way down?
All right. We got to.
I just wouldn't even use the word myth. Like, I just, like, I, this casual use of myth just continues to irk me. But
well, David, when's your book coming out?
It's with
before the second coming.
Right now, I was hoping to have it out in time for the debate tonight, and just not quite going to make it. Part of the problem is that when everything push came to shove, what I thought was going to be a 500-page book turned out to be a 900-some-odd-page book. So it's now going to be three books, and hopefully those are all going to be coming out within the month, if not within the year.
Well, we've talked about this book for years. Does it actually exist, or is it a myth?
No, right? But we'll have physical evidence that can be examined.
And if anyone wants to respond, it'll have to be 1,800 pages, as I was alluding to in the debate.
Yeah. Can I just say, I was really taken aback by Bart saying that, well, I would respond to it, but then it would be this. And it's like, you know, that's a little condescending. You know, you could just – because, so, you know, I'm not saying that we've got all the answers, but we've got some good questions that could use an answer or two. And some of them – and some points, Bart, I think he just sidesteps things that – need to be addressed, at least.
All right, we got to wrap it up here, fellas.
I'm going to defend him now and bring in James, because this is your life.
No. Okay, well, what exactly are you asking me to defend? I will say that, you know, you can't address everything. You know,
He writes blog posts. He's the chair of a prestigious R1 institution. He has PhDs to supervise. He has to give an introduction to the New Testament every year with a class of 300 people.
Fair enough.
Like, we have lives to live.
Fair enough.
And I have people on my blog getting angry with me when I say, you know, could you do me a favor and read this blog post in which I've already addressed this? And we'll take up the conversation from there. And they accuse me of being condescending, but, you know, we have to sometimes recap the previous conversation to bring new people in, and yet we can't do that all the time, because none of us has the time to do that, you know. So.
I get it.
I appreciate you all coming on so late, and definitely Dr. Crosley for staying up till 3 a.m. his time.
Well, what we're going to do is we'll go just into final thoughts, 30 seconds. Let's start with you, David. What were your final thoughts, the takeaway moments to wrap up the debate this evening?
I thought it was a good start. I think there's just so much more left to say about this, not just the state of Jesus studies, but the actual arguments in question. And Robert Price is very smart and very erudite and knows this plethora of information that I think he didn't have to go so far in the weeds. He could have kept with examples closer to home and made his point better, I think.
What about you, Daniel?
While this was highly enjoyable, it went down pretty much as I predicted. To me, I think the mythicist craze is coming to an end. I think this is going to be one of the last events in its resurgence, and I think it's probably. I don't think it's going to die out by any stretch of the imagination. But I think the fascination with it is coming to an end.
You had to say that and get David going.
Let me tell you something.
What about you, Dr. McGrath?
I'm not saying it's over. I just think the fascination is, like, people will still be engaged and people will still have these debates online, but I think the mass halls being filled, I think we're seeing a decline in that, and this event is a part of that.
You know what? I just want to chime in one thing, because, I mean, how do you not respond to that?
Yeah, I got to let you respond.
It's just that in biblical studies, especially in biblical studies, if you look at the last 100 years, today's blasphemy is tomorrow's consensus, and twas ever thus. And we'll see.
All right, Dr. McGrath, your final thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to say, even though at the risk of having David jump back in one more time, that, you know, we'll see. You know, this is a theory in crisis. We've heard that before, right? But I want to have as my final thought, you know, I've said that I think Aaron made a few points that I've also tried to make sometimes online in conversations, but very, very clearly and succinctly, better than I feel he'd ever done them, you know, in terms of a quick soundbite that you could grasp quickly. But I want to express some appreciation for Dr. Price, because, I mean, I'm not persuaded by his views, but he is, you know, very, very, has interesting things to say. You know, he asks interesting questions, he does them in interesting ways, and he's also extremely entertaining. Right. I mean, when talking about euhemerism and suggests, you know, Apollo, the owner of a tanning salon, that was wonderful. When he, you know, gave these subtitles, you know, and I apologize for the ones that weren't quite as funny as Testimonium Flimsianum. You know,
Razel Ghul.
Yes, in the chain, right, the fabrication of the Isnad chain of the Hadith, he mentions Razel Ghul. I mean, the. You know, I'm not persuaded that someone like Clark Kent is an analogy to Jesus, that's helpful, but I appreciated some of these references that were in there. He made the case, made it entertaining, and so I enjoyed listening to him, even when I disagreed with him.
Well, thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming on. I appreciate your time this late, especially after hearing two experts talk about Jesus for 3 hours, and you're still not burnt out.
Before you go, David got to plug his work. Dr. McGrath, do you have anything to plug?
Well, it's something which, you know, if you interpret the title in a way that is not intended, then it could certainly be treated as having something to do with mythicism. But my latest book is actually about theology and science fiction. But I don't discuss Jesus in outer space, so that's really, you know, if you're interested in mythicism, this book is going to be a disappointment. So.
And Daniel, you are giving a lecture or a paper at Society of Biblical Literature in November. You're pretty excited about that.
Yes, I'm talking. Sorry, David, I am talking about the decline of mythicism. Sorry.
Oh, I won't.
All right. Well, thank you again, gentlemen. And for everyone else, please stay tuned in the future for Who Do They Say That I Am?
Thank you so much, folks. It's good night. I'm tired.
Good night, everyone.
All right, everyone go to bed. Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, I just hung up on them, Eric. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us tonight. This will be on iTunes tomorrow morning. It'll be on our SoundCloud channel, and you can definitely follow up anytime. If you joined us late, just hit the rewind button. And that is all from Who They Say That I Am, and I hope you all enjoyed the discussion. Bye-bye.